There are two other families I would like to acknowledge this morning, both members at one time of this congregation, Mike and Susan Bloodhart, visiting from Denver up in the balcony, and the Joel Taylors. And you were here before. By some wondrous chance, have you moved back? Oh, that is good news. Welcome. The pulpit is not a place for personal reminiscences, except when they relate in some way to religion and offer a few insights into the life of imagination and faith. So the sermon this morning, called Notes from a Journey, is not a travelogue, but a few reflections from a vacation in Switzerland so recent that Billy and I still have not gotten our biological time clocks back in good shape. My first observation is that if beauty is truth, as a famous poem claims, then we came back with some kind of useful truth, because there was incredible beauty everywhere around us. Saas-Fee near the Matterhorn and a charming little town called Wingen at the foot of the Jungfraujoch were so beautiful that they hardly seemed real. Wingen was best with that explosion of flowers so amazing to an American, particularly one who lives in Wichita, and the hiking trails through high mountain meadows and the breathtaking view of a huge glacier creeping toward us from the Jungfrau itself. On the Sunday when Jim Kelly preached so well in my absence, I have heard that already, on that Sunday night from 9 to 10, I sat on a balcony and watched a full moon sail out from behind the highest peak in Switzerland. I've lived a while and been in some lovely places, but I've never seen anything more awesome in my life. The massive glacier shining in the moonlight, and far below it a little toy village, silent except for a distant church bell tolling the hour. I felt as close to the mystery of creation as I have ever felt anywhere, including the hours of formal worship. I sat there remembering a place in the Bible where an enemy says of the Hebrew people that their gods are gods of the hills, and so they are stronger than we are. It's an interesting comment, because one of the Israelite names for their deity was El Shaddai, which may translate God of the Mountain. I looked up at the Jungfrau and understood why such a place might become a symbol for the majesty of God. Not many things on earth are as eternal as the granite hills, changeless in the short history of mankind. I suppose the Jewish people could have had a sea god like Neptune, except that they had no dealings with the sea, no harbor, no boats through most of their history. The sea was a mysterious and forbidding place to them. But the hills were another matter, because when they came into Palestine, the land they took from the Canaanites, they found safety up in the hill country. Hardly the Alps or the Rockies, only 2,500 feet high, but impressive after all their years in the desert, with one of them, Mount Hermon, far up to the north, snow-capped and imposing. They would surely have settled on the fertile Mediterranean coast if they had dared, but until they could consolidate their conquest, they had to hide in the hills. Safe from the Philistines, their mortal enemies, who held the seacoast and had chariots of iron that were invincible in the flatlands, but could be outmaneuvered in the hills, or at least escaped. So the Hebrew God is a hill God who revealed himself on a mountain to Moses, a God defined as power, eternal, unshakable. People have always tended to define their God by what is around them. The Indians did it, the Eskimo, the Amazonian River tribe. William Wordsworth, a cultivated Englishman, lived in the placid, pretty lake country of England, an utterly domestic and safe place. And so the God he presents in his poetry is a gentle, altogether unfrightening God. Thomas Huxley wrote a satirical little essay called Wordsworth in the Tropics, in which he asked what kind of God Wordsworth would have imagined to be behind the universe if he had lived in the equatorial rainforest, where God's creation included poison snakes and spiders, huge tarantulas, man-eating crocodiles, prowling jaguars, 10,000 kinds of hostile insects, and a whole catalog of deadly diseases from jungle fever to leprosy. The point is that if you read the face of God from the face of nature, as humanity has always tended to do, it will not be the same face everywhere in the world. For the ancient Hebrews, who wrote the book we call the Old Testament, God was first of all a God of the hills. So thinking of Mount Sinai and of Mount Olympus, where the Greek gods lived, I considered what a majestic God might have lived up there over my head on the moon-struck, icy Jungfrau. It was a sobering thought. On that same balcony, at another time, I had a different kind of experience, which no one else in our party of four witnessed, and which at least one of them, my professor, minister friend from Dallas, Dr. Paul McGee, claims must have been a vision granted only to Congregationalists and not to Camelites like himself. Standing on the balcony about six, waiting for the walk down to village for dinner, Billy's favorite time of the day, I saw a helicopter coming toward me from an opposite mountain across a deep valley. I could tell it was trailing a sling with something in it, so I thought there had been an accident and that one or two mountain climbers were being brought to the hospital. But as the copter got closer, I saw to my astonishment that it was carrying one of those big brown Swiss cows lying on its back in the sling with all 4 feet up in the air, stiffly, finished forever, it seemed to me, with the business of producing milk. Full of curiosity and forcing myself to overcome my customary reticence, I set out to find out what was happening. It was explained to me that cows, not as sure-footed as goats, fall over the cliffs from time to time, and the Swiss, being a tidy and frugal people, bring them in for rendering. Now, Dr. Paul, who snaps even more pictures than a busload of Japanese tourists, was very unhappy at missing this chance and kept teasing all through the trip. How is Bob going to make this biblical and work it into a sermon? I finally reminded him that the Apostle Peter once had a vision of a great sheet tied at the corners, dropping out of the sky like my chopper, with all kinds of animals in it, including probably cows, and heard a voice from heaven telling him what he was supposed to do next. Now, Luke has a special reason for telling that story, but if my glimpse of a helicoptered cow was meant to point me in a new direction or rub out some prejudice, as in the case of the Apostle Peter, I don't know what it was. And I'm not even sure why I'm telling you this, except that Paul and Peggy hear these tapes down in Dallas, and if I didn't confess to the vision of the cow in the copter net, they would never forgive me. That is taken care of. I called the Swiss frugal when I mentioned that they were bringing the cow back to get what use they could from it, and frugal is a polite understatement. In the anniversary roast last February, I was accused of being a depression child who cannot bear to waste anything or throw anything away that might someday be useful. Well, I learned something about frugality from the Swiss. From those little cakes of soap they give you in the hotel that are about the size of a quarter and not much thicker and which they think should last for 3 days. And from the culture shock we got when we asked for a glass of water, plain water, and paid $2.75 for it with no ice. And from that memorable meal, before I learned better, when I asked why my bill was $2 higher than the menu price, only to be told that this was the charge for 2 tiny pats of butter, which I had requested. And all this in a land where water tumbles down every mountain, ice cold and clear, and cows are milked in every meadow. It gave new meaning to the word conservation. And along with many other things I saw, it made me realize better than ever what an incredibly wasteful people we are with the resources inherited in this great sprawling country. Now, a word about coincidence and how you fit coincidence into your understanding of human life. And after that, a brief comment about serendipity, that wonderful word we got from an English novel called The Three Princes of Serendip, in which the heroes had a knack for making desirable discoveries quite by accident. But first, the tiny threads of coincidence that span oceans and mountain ranges, reach into remote villages, ride on toy trains through the valleys of Switzerland. Here is such a moment. We're on a little red train near Gstaad when a conversation starts up with an American couple in the neighboring seats. We did not see many American couples, so this was a special delight. He turned out to be a professor of trumpet from St. Cloud State in Minnesota. His wife is a concert pianist. They had spent the summer teaching in England, and now they were on vacation in Switzerland. He asks where I live and compliments the music department at Wichita State. He has known several students, he says, who were taught by a man at Wichita State whom he clearly admires enormously. And suddenly, rocking along between the Alps and the lush green meadows, the continent of Europe shrinks, the ocean becomes the pond next door, and we are talking, believe it or not, about Walt Myers. the Walt Myers who has just played the trumpet and made the announcements. Well, our friend of 30 minutes had the highest praise for you, Walt, and hoped you might remember a record some 15 years ago with you featured on one side and this man playing on the other. And you'll be glad to know that we did not diminish his fond memories. By mentioning to him that life in your declining years has been clouded by the tardy arrival of a pipe organ. I don't know where to put coincidence in a system of faith, but it's certainly one of life's more tantalizing faces. We marveled that day at the interconnecting network of our lives, reminded in that odd moment that we never completely leave home. I'm skipping something now so I don't keep you very long. Serendipity. Well, that happened in a little Swiss town where we had stopped to change trains on a day trip. We had a rare half hour of rain, so we huddled under an awning with two strangers who had also taken refuge there. Paul McGee, who may be even more garrulous than I am, asked where they came from. The man said, rather defensively, I thought, that they were from Asia, which was clearly meant to be off-putting and obscure. But Paul persisted. Where in Asia? The man said, in the East. And it was even clearer that he meant to remain anonymous. But then suddenly he seemed to sense that we might be briefly admissible into his life, even if we were Americans. So he smiled at his wife to let her know it was all right, and he confessed. We are Jewish. We live in Israel. On his face, in his eyes, we read the reason for his initial reluctance. Under siege, battered by world opinion, he had grown weary of talking about it with strangers. Now, for a moment, which he knew would pass soon and forever, he became willing again. We talked about Iraq, of course, and Saddam Hussein. His solution was neither polite nor pleasant. He hoped the Americans would destroy Saddam quickly and without diplomatic niceties. His sensitive face got so intense that he stopped suddenly to apologize. But then, I am a Jew, and what would you expect me to say? Here I stand offending nice people I have just met in the street. We must not talk politics anymore. But we convinced him that we would be over open-minded, and we did talk. And if you ask Billy, she will say that that single half hour was worth the whole trip. I asked Simon, as the rain stopped, how he would solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem. He sighed and said, I don't know. And then with a wry smile, if I did, I would be the prime minister. It was only a brief vignette in those glorious vacation days, but one we will not forget. An encounter that suddenly turned the headlines into flesh and blood, gave a human face to an ancient quarrel, touched us with the troubled history of all humanity, and opened up our hearts again to the mysteries of providence and the need to know and to hope. Oh yes, he said, I still hope. What would be left if there were no hope? And unable to escape being a minister, I thought of the famous words, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. And it may make no sense to you at all, but in some odd, touching way, Billy and I felt love for this tormented man who had tried for 50 years to live out his dream in Israel. Love, in spite of the fact that he had grown cynical and bitter. Love, because behind the cynicism, we sensed the desperate hope that there might somehow still be peace. One comes back enriched in unexpected ways, a little more a citizen of the world than before, a little less parochial and narrow-minded, and above all, grateful, deeply, deeply grateful to be coming home to you.